Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
It was an historic moment at the Supreme Court today.
I, Ketanji Brown Jackson, do solemnly swear
that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
That I will support.
Ketanji Brown Jackson was today sworn in as the nation's 116th justice and the first black woman ever to serve on the high court. Her husband, Dr. Patrick Jackson, held two Bibles on which she swore, a family Bible and the court's Harlan Bible. A former federal appeal court judge and public defender, Jackson replaced Justice Stephen Breyer, who stepped down today after nearly three decades on the bench. Justice Breyer hired Ketanji Brown Jackson as a clerk in 1999, making it a full circle moment when he administered the judicial oath to her today. A formal investiture for Justice Jackson is expected in the fall. We can call her that now, Justice Jackson. But taking her oaths today allows her to begin her judicial duties. Justice Jackson, of course, arrives on the bench in the wake of several hugely polarizing decisions issued by the court on abortion, gun rights, and today's ruling limiting the EPA's authority to fight climate change. We're going to have much more on that ruling specifically and on the future of the court and its newest member just ahead. But before we get to all of that, do you remember when the Donald Trump campaign was caught scamming its own donors? I just have to read you the lead from the New York Times, the story that broke the scandal open. Quote, Stacey Blatt was in hospice care in September 2020, listening to Rush Limbaugh's dire warnings about how badly Donald Trump's campaign needed money when he went online and chipped in everything he could, $500. It was a big sum for a 63-year-old battling cancer and living in Kansas City on less than $1,000 a month. But that single contribution quickly multiplied. Another $500 was withdrawn the next day, then $500 the next week, and every week through mid-October without his knowledge, until Mr. Blatt's bank account had been depleted and frozen. When his utility and rent payments bounced, he called his brother, Russell, for help. What the Blatt soon discovered was $3,000 in withdrawals by the Trump campaign in less than 30 days. They called their bank and said they thought they were victims of fraud. Russell said, quote, it felt like it was a scam. It was. It was a scam. The Trump campaign was putting these little checkboxes on its online donation portal. They were already pre-checked when you went to make a donation. The fine print saying that if you were agreeing to make a weekly donation, well, that was buried beneath all this bold-faced, all-capped verbiage. So if you did not want the Trump campaign to keep reaching into your bank account or your credit card, you'd have to see those boxes, read them, understand them, and then uncheck them. The then president of the United States raked in millions of dollars perpetrating this scam on his most ardent supporters. But as it turned out, that was just the beginning, because then Trump launched something called Save America PAC, ostensibly to raise money to fight the stolen election. He raised hundreds of millions of dollars from his supporters to stop the steal, except it's not where the money all went. Here's how one of the January 6th investigators laid it out in a public hearing earlier this month.
Between Election Day and January 6th, the Trump campaign sent millions of fundraising emails to Trump supporters, sometimes as many as 25 a day. They continued to barrage small dollar donors with emails, encouraging them to donate to something called the Official Election Defense Fund. The Select Committee discovered no such fund existed. The claims that the election was stolen were so successful, President Trump and his allies raised $250 million, nearly $100 million in the first week after the election. On November 9th, 2020, President Trump created a separate entity called the Save America PAC. Most of the money raised went to this newly created PAC, not to election-related litigation. The Select Committee discovered that the Save America PAC made millions of dollars of contributions to pro-Trump organizations, including $1 million to Trump Chief of Staff Mark Meadows' charitable foundation, $1 million to the America First Policy Institute, a conservative organization which employs several former Trump administration officials, $204,857 to the Trump Hotel Collection, and over $5 million to Event Strategies, Inc., the company that ran President Trump's January 6th rally on the Ellipse.
Throughout the committee's investigation, we found evidence that the Trump campaign and its surrogates misled donors as to where their funds would go and what they would be used for. So not only was there the big lie, there was the big ripoff.
The big ripoff. So Donald Trump's been raising all this money, hundreds of millions of dollars, by promising supporters that he can still win the 2020 election or something. But in fact, lots of the money is just lining his and his friends' pockets. And now we have reason to worry that some of the money might be being spent in more insidious ways. Because here is what the congresswoman who you just heard, Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren, who sits on the January 6th committee, told me last night.
We know that large amounts of money have been spent out of the fund that was amassed by the former president and is being used to pay for lawyers to various witnesses. The potential for coercion in that case is pretty obvious.
What the congresswoman is describing there is a neat trick. Donald Trump raises all this money supposedly to try to overturn the 2020 election results. Then along comes this giant investigation into his attempts to overturn the election. So Donald Trump uses that big pile of money to pay for lawyers for all the people who used to work for him who are being subpoenaed by that very investigation. And you may not be a lawyer, I certainly am not, but you don't have to have a law degree to understand why it might be, in the congresswoman's words, coercive for Trump to be paying for witnesses' lawyers. Imagine you are, say, Cassidy Hutchinson, a White House staffer subpoenaed by the January 6th investigation, and Donald Trump is paying for your lawyer. Well, whose own interests is your lawyer serving, yours or Trump's? And hanging over your head at all times is the possibility that if you displease Trump somehow, he might cut off the money and you'll lose your representation. Today, one of Cassidy Hutchinson's former White House colleagues said that it was her understanding that when Ms. Hutchinson first testified behind closed doors months ago, she was represented by a lawyer paid for by Trump or his allies.
Cassidy actually came to me and said, there's more I want to share with the committee. A couple months ago, I put her in touch with Congresswoman Cheney. She got a new lawyer, and that's how this testimony came about.
She came to you and said she had more even after she'd spoken to them once?
Yeah, so what people need to understand is Trump world was assigning lawyers to a lot of these staffers who themselves, you know, don't have big
assigning lawyers.
Well, I should say covering the cost of lawyers for people who don't have big legal defense funds to themselves.
Oh, so have they were their paying own. Cassidy Hutchinson's lawyer
is my understanding. You'd have to confirm that. But she had someone, Stephen Positano, who'd been in the White House counsel's office, is still aligned with Trump world. She did her interview. She complied with the committee. But she shared with me, there is more I want to share that was not asked in those settings. How do we do this? And in that process, she got a new attorney of her own.
Well, the name that the former White House staffer there was searching for was Pasentino, Stefan Pasentino. He was Cassidy Hutchinson's lawyer until about a month ago. He's a former Trump White House lawyer with all kinds of Trump world connections. Was he being paid by Trump to represent Ms. Hutchinson? Well, we don't know that. We reached out to Mr. Pasentino today. We've not heard back. But what we do know is that a law firm Stefan Pasentino runs has been getting regular payments of tens of thousands of dollars from that very same Trump Save America PAC. Here are the payments from Trump's Save America PAC to Pasentino's firm, Elections LLC, for the last year and a half for legal consulting. Payments ranging from $10,000 to $45,000 multiple times a month. Now, to be entirely clear, Mr. Pasentino is a lawyer. It's entirely possible that all this money he's getting from Trump's PAC is for actual legal services rendered that have nothing to do with representing Cassidy Hutchinson. Again, we've reached out to Mr. Pasentino, and we haven't heard anything back. But you've got to admit, if you're a witness before the January 6th investigation and your lawyer is getting regular payments from Donald Trump's quasi-slush fund PAC, that creates an awkward situation. It may explain why Cassidy Hutchinson became so much more forthcoming once she switched lawyers about a month ago. Makes you wonder if there are other witnesses who are repped by lawyers being paid by Trump or Trump World or this super PAC, and what they might be willing to say under different circumstances if they had their own lawyers, or at least lawyers who are not paid for by Trump or his allies. I can tell you that FEC records show payments from that same Trump PAC, Save America, to law firms representing several other January 6th witnesses. Again, doesn't mean those payments are specifically tied to the representation of those witnesses. Someone else might be paying for those witnesses. Those witnesses might be paying their own bills. We don't know that information yet. But you can understand why January 6th investigators would be very interested in that information. Following the money. Especially when the committee's already put forward evidence of witness intimidation by Trump allies, messages to witnesses that appear to be veiled threats, reminding witnesses that Trump is watching and urging them to, quote, do the right thing. Here's what Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren told me last night about that.
I'm not going to comment on which witness those threatening messages were sent to, but obviously if you read them, there's an intent to dissuade a witness from testifying honestly. So this is a concern. And I just want people who would try and interfere with a witness, who would coerce them or threaten them, to know that that's not legal. And we do not intend to just sit by and watch that happen. As to witness intimidation, that's a crime. Mm-hmm. And if individuals who are trying to protect the president are committing a crime, we intend to take the evidence that we get of that and not just sit on it. People ought to be aware that committing the crime of witness tampering is a serious matter, and it's not going to be ignored.
Now, Donald Trump and his allies like to claim that the January 6th investigation is a ridiculous sideshow that they're not even paying attention to. But it sure seems like behind the scenes, they're working pretty hard to keep witnesses from saying too much or saying what they don't want them to say. Joining us now, Barbara McQuaid, former United States Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. She's now a professor at the University of Michigan Law School and an MSNBC legal analyst. Barbara, good evening to you and good to see you. Thank you for being with us. I just want to keep pulling on this thread. Last night when we had Congresswoman Lofgren on, she told me that some of the money raised by the Save America PAC has been going to lawyers to represent Trump staffers who are being asked to cooperate with the January 6th investigation. Now, just tonight, brand new reporting from the New York Times reports that at least a dozen of the January 6th witnesses are either having their legal fees paid by Trump's political organization and his allies, or have received promises that they will do so. So I have to ask you, as a former prosecutor, what does this all mean when you hear about these things? Is it relevant when you are prosecuting someone and someone other than that person or their family are paying their legal bills?
It is absolutely something that is of concern. It's lawful for somebody to pay someone else's legal bills. There's not a problem with that. There's not a crime with that. But the lawyer's ethical obligation is to represent the client, regardless of who is paying the bills. Sometimes you would see these matters come before the court, and the court can play referee a little bit to make sure that the client is satisfied with the legal representation and that the client believes that the lawyer is representing the client's best interests. But there is an inherent conflict of interest there. You know, Michael Cohen has described that this is how it works in Trump world. And when the lawyer is being paid by someone else, there is at least a human element of an incentive to please the one who's paying you as opposed to the one that you are representing.
Is there the January 6th investigation is not a prosecution by nature, by virtue of what the committee is, how it's constituted and what it's allowed to do. But Donald Trump and his activities are subject of that investigation. If this were a court case, would that make a difference? Would it make a difference if the person paying the bills of the witnesses is the person being investigated?
I think it's probably problematic in both contexts, because what you want to avoid is some sort of obstruction of justice, that the lawyer is persuading the witness not to be as forthcoming as they might otherwise be, because they want to please the boss. And so I think in either context, it's very problematic. And at its worst, it could be a crime of obstruction of justice. At its best, it is somebody generously paying the legal fees of a person who can't otherwise afford it. But I think it is it behooves the fact finder, whether it's a judge or in this case, the members of Congress, to make sure that this sees the light of day, that people understand what this relationship is. Because I think that transparency is the best way to expose wrongdoing.
But to be clear, if I am being investigated, if I'm being deposed, if I am testifying before the committee and I'm being represented by a lawyer who's paid for by Donald Trump's super PAC, the lawyer I have has got to represent me and my interests. That's their ethical responsibility as a lawyer.
That's absolutely right, Ellie. They can't ask you to pull punches or lie or fail to be as forthcoming as you might otherwise be just because someone else is paying the bills. Their loyalty lies with the client.
I want to go down this road of intimidation. One of the messages that was allegedly sent to Cassidy Hutchinson warned, quote, Trump does read transcripts. I'm not sure what that's supposed to mean. Is the suggestion there that one of the Trump lawyers representing a January 6th witness may have been passing deposition transcripts to former President Trump? Does that matter?
Well, I think, number one, we don't know that those would have been accessible to Donald Trump. So the fact that if he actually is reading transcripts, does that suggest that he's got some improper access? What I think it tends to mean is watch what you say, because Donald Trump is going to know every word that you say. And so be careful, be loyal. Remember whose team you're on here, all of those kinds of things. I think that they are really careful not to go so far as to say, be sure to lie for the boss. But they do say things like, we're watching. And that is enough, I think, to very subtly suggest that you need to remember whose team you're on.
Barbara, good to see you. Thank you for being with us. Barbara McQuaid is a former United States attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan and an MSNBC legal analyst. Always a pleasure to see you, my friend.
Thank you, Ellie.
Well, today the Supreme Court made a decision that has an impact on the entire world. We're going to break down that decision and what can be done to fight it next.
The UN Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, responds to emergencies and provides long-term solutions for refugees. They provide aid in over 130 countries, including Ukraine, Syria, Afghanistan, and Sudan, where people are forced to flee from war and persecution at their greatest moment of need. UNHCR helps and protects refugees by providing food, shelter, medical care, and other life-saving essentials. The agency jumpstarts relief in three key ways. They transport core relief items stored in even the most remote areas of the world. They deploy expert emergency staff trained to help in crisis situations. And they transfer funds directly to support the emergency. Because of generous supporters and donors, UNHCR can scale up its response within 72 hours of a large-scale emergency. Your support helps provide life-saving aid for refugees whenever and wherever emergencies occur. Donate to USA for UNHCR by visiting unrefugees.org/donation.
They're hounding you out of office just like they did to me. Where did we go wrong?
Annie, I don't know. We tried. We always said if we accomplish even one small thing, bring a little smile to one major strip miner, a little happiness to one large oil cartel, then it's all worth it. How were we repaid?
In unmarked 50s and 100s.
That was SNL in 1983, making fun of a couple of scandal-plagued Reagan cabinet members, the Interior Secretary James Watt, and the former EPA administrator, Ann Burford. Ann has since passed on, but her legacy lives on. Her obituary described her by saying she wore fur coats and smoked two packs of Marlboros a day. Her government-issued car got about 15 miles per gallon. She was an EPA administrator who worked actively to gut the EPA. The Washington Post remembers her as a firm believer that the federal government, and specifically the EPA, was too big, too wasteful, and too restrictive of business. She cut the EPA's budget by 22% and boasted that she reduced the thickness of the Book of Clean Water Regulations from 6 inches to half an inch. Under her watch, the agency tried to set aside a 30 by 40 mile rectangle of ocean due east of the Delaware, Maryland coast, where incinerator ships would burn toxic waste at 1200 degrees centigrade. She was eventually forced out of the EPA over a scandal about mismanaging a $1.6 billion program to clean up hazardous waste dumps. But like I said, her legacy, the desire to gut the EPA, Well, that legacy lives on in her now adult son, the Supreme Court Associate Justice Neil Gorsuch. Not only did the Supreme Court rule 6-3 against Biden's EPA today, severely curtailing the EPA's ability to limit greenhouse gas emissions, but Gorsuch authored a concurring opinion, voting with the majority and signaling that he would go even further in limiting agencies' power if he could. Today is a sad day for our planet and a day that has been long in the making, but getting depressed helps no one, so I want to know what we can do. And just like Ann Burford and her son, Neil Gorsuch, have been in this fight for decades, so has our next guest. He's a pioneer in environmental activism. Joining us now is Bill McKibben. Bill is an environmentalist and the founder of an organization called Third Act, which is comprised of people over the age of 60 who are determined to change the world for the better. He's also the author of a memoir called The Flag, The Cross, and The Station Wagon. Bill, good to see you again. Thank you for being with us tonight.
A real pleasure to be with you, friend.
Bill, tell me, can you help us understand what exactly this ruling does to the EPA? It limits their ability to limit or restrict the negative, environmentally negative output of power plants.
That's right. The EPA is filled with experts whose job it is to figure out how to regulate the pollution that comes out of power plants and things. But the Supreme Court today said, we don't care about that. If there's going to be any serious regulation, Congress has to specifically tell us how much methane or what kind of carbon or, you know, on and on down the list. And of course, as anybody who's followed Congress, as you have every night for years now, knows, that's exactly the same thing as saying we'll not have any regulation at all. In facing the greatest crisis the world has ever faced, this goes a long ways towards removing the chance that the U.S. will step up to its obligations.
I suppose very much like abortion, there are a number of us who have come to sort of think that the world has moved ahead, that we have changed our views as it relates to environmentalism, that we have discounted the deniers, and that they're not sort of, they don't have an equal place at the table. And then suddenly a ruling like this comes down, which shows that not only do the deniers have an equal place at the table, they've got a prominent place at the table. They've got a leadership role in the discussion. How does this come to pass in 2022 when it seems that most people in the world, at least outside of America, but even in America, most people seem to think that environmental damage is done when there's an absence of regulation?
Well, Ali, I think you've really hit the nail squarely on the head. Each of the big decisions in the last week, the one that made it easy to carry guns any place you wanted, the one that overturned a woman's right to choose, and now this one that's gutting the Clean Air Act, they're all deeply unpopular. These are all things that by margins of 65, 70, 75, 80, 90%, Americans want done. And so what we're seeing is the payoff of a 50-year effort that predates even Ann Gorsuch. I mean, we go back straight to that famous memo that Lewis Powell, soon to become a justice of the Supreme Court, wrote in 1971, within months of the Clean Air Act being adopted, saying, business has to get its act together so that we can stand up to this kind of regulation. This is today the thing that the Koch brothers were working for. That's what the last few decades of right-wing organizing and court packing and everything else was about. And it's going to put us in a real hole. But, and this is important, these things are so unpopular that they should be the springboard for a kind of reaction. We need now leadership out of the Democratic Party and out of Joe Biden to really take this to the American public. I said the other day that Joe Biden should say, my frame is not going to darken the White House door for the next 132 days until this election. I'm going to be out every day. Get me a train. I like Amtrak. I'm going to crisscross the country taking this case because now he has a case to make. Now we don't have to have an election that's just dominated by inflation. Now people understand that the most basic rights and the most basic questions about the future, not just of our country, but our planet, are at stake. So this is a terrible week, but if the Supreme Court kicked over a hornet's nest, then maybe, maybe something good can be salvaged from it.
You talk about the Clean Air Act and you mentioned business. So you've walked into my wheelhouse now. And something you wrote in the New Yorker struck me today. You mentioned that while the conservative push to roll back environmental regulations have been profit driven since the 1980s, including the work done by the Koch brothers, you mentioned that it's more ideological than practical now because climate change is going to lead to such a financially unstable world. Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, look, the current high-end estimate for economic damage from unchecked global warming, the last number I saw was $551 trillion by century's end, which is more money than currently exists on planet Earth. I mean, we're talking about an issue by far the largest thing that human beings have ever done. While the Supreme Court is playing these kind of ideological games on behalf of the vested interests that want to delay our energy transition for a couple of decades, while they're doing that, the Arctic is melting, the seas are rising, we're seeing fire and flood and drought on scales we've never observed before. This couldn't be more serious, and they couldn't be at some level less serious. All they're doing is carrying water for the fossil fuel industry. They've gotten their money's worth for the, ever since Citizens United, what they've poured into this system, they've return on investment's been staggering.
Bill, good to see you. Thanks for the work that you do. And like the work they've been doing for decades, you've been doing this work for decades. Bill McKibben is an environmentalist. He's the founder of the organization Third Act, the author of a memoir called The Flag, The Cross, and The Station Wagon. We appreciate your time, sir. Well, today was the end of the Supreme Court term, and to put it lightly, as Bill said, the decisions we got this term were bananas. We'll talk to the great Dahlia Lithwick about all of those decisions and the future of the court on the other side of this break.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
After over 230 years, today at noon, it finally happened. With her swearing in earlier this afternoon, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson became the first black woman to sit on the Supreme Court after Justice Stephen Breyer retired today after nearly 30 years on the high court himself. Justice Jackson said in a written statement today, quote, "With a full heart, I accept the solemn responsibility of supporting and defending the Constitution of the United States and administering justice without fear or favor. So help me God." And Justice Jackson is joining the nation's highest court in an historically divisive time, a Supreme Court under siege from the weight of popular opinion. Tomorrow will mark 1 week since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade and ruled that an abortion is not a constitutional right after nearly 50 years of precedent that said that it was. Protests have erupted across the nation. 7 states have already banned abortion, several following suit soon. Today, as we just heard, the court ruled against the Biden administration's Environmental Protection Agency, limiting the agency's authority to regulate emissions, delivering a serious blow to our planet. But not all the decisions today had the liberals in the minority. Today, the court also rejected a challenge to the Biden administration's attempt to end Trump's Remain in Mexico policy, which sent migrants seeking refuge in the U.S. back across the border to wait to be heard. And the court declined to take up a legal challenge brought by the healthcare workers in New York who opposed the state's vaccine mandate on religious grounds. Justices Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch said the court should take the case up, but they were in the minority. While today ends this year's term, the court agreed to hear one case from North Carolina for next term that could have potentially cataclysmic repercussions. The Washington Post writes, quote, the Supreme Court on Thursday said it will consider what would be a radical change in the way federal elections are conducted, giving state legislatures sole authority to set the rules for contests, even if their actions violated state constitutions and resulted in extreme partisan gerrymandering for congressional seats. Even if their actions violated state constitutions. Republicans argue that the courts have no right to second-guess state legislatures when it concerns federal elections. The buck stops with the legislatures, they say. If the Supreme Court decides this case in the Republicans' favor next term, state courts would no longer be a check on state lawmakers when it comes to our nation's elections. And that is something to digest for a moment. Because after what we saw happen in the 2020 election with states trying to send fake electors to Congress, this could lead to catastrophic consequences for our democracy, or at least extreme partisan gerrymandering across the country the next time they get the chance. This case is about North Carolina, but if the conservative justices rule in favor of the Republicans, it could have an outsized impact because Republicans control both houses of state legislatures in 30 states. What does the future of this conservative court look like? What can we expect next term? Well, I've got just the person to ask. Joining us now is Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor and legal correspondent for Slate.com. Dahlia, good to see you. Thanks for making time for us tonight. What was your reaction when you learned that the court would be taking up this case from North Carolina about state legislatures having absolute power over elections and that courts can't get involved in decisions made by the legislature, even if those decisions seem to be counter to the Constitution?
Yeah, this was the thermonuclear option. This was the thing we've all been waiting to see if the court was going to take up. And I think you've described it perfectly. I mean, this was more or less the theory that was being pushed by John Eastman and Jeffrey Clark and the folks who were asking to set aside the results of the 2020 election. So the idea that the court is now agreeing to take it up in advance of the 2024 election, we know, by the way, that there's already four justices who have signaled in various cases that have come before it. There's already four justices who are kind of on board with this. So the idea that the court is teeing this up in advance of 2024 is pretty bone-chilling.
Let's talk about this for a second. The idea is that the courts are there, if they're operating properly, to have a check on when there's legislation that is challenged because it is deemed to be unconstitutional. What's the logic behind a case like this? What's the logic behind saying the courts can't have a role in even if the states do something that's wrong?
I think you're making the mistake of trying to find logic. This is a profound misreading of, you know, an opinion in Bush v. Gore that only garnered three votes. It's a profound misreading of the word legislature. This is another one of those ideas that kind of comes up from, you know, the bowels of the kind of far, far, far reaches of the conservative legal movement. It has no actual salience. It's just really, I think, a totally instrumental way to give state legislatures the power to override the judiciary. And I think that, you know, we can talk for hours and hours about what the word legislature means mm-hmm. in this construction, but the truth is it's just another one of those theories that didn't exist until it did, and now evidently it does.
You wrote in Slate in your latest piece about the court this term, and you said that, quote, those arguing the brand new jurisprudence emerging this week is markedly more cruel, more overtly theological, and more contemptuous of the regulatory state are all correct. Talk to me about what you meant by that.
This term has been like nothing I have ever seen and nothing that most court watchers have ever seen. It has been both a kind of ends-driven maximalist, you know, swing for the fences, go for broke on everything kind of term, And I've been thinking about this a lot in the last week, and it occurs to me that we've been so institutionalized that we tend to say, oh, there's a new test for gun regulations. They built a new test. There's a new test for abortion regulations. They built a new test. There's a new test for church-state separation. They built a new test. Today, they built a new test, this weird major questions doctrine that is going to be going forward how we think about regulatory agencies. And we make the mistake of sicking con law professors on this as though there's a new test today. There's no new test. The test is whatever the court wants. The police always wins. The religion always wins. Women always lose. The condemned always die. And I think we're just making a mistake of treating this like doctrine. It's not doctrine. It's just a checklist of what this conservative legal movement has always wanted.
That's a big deal coming from you, because you watch this very closely, and you're not pessimistic and skeptical about the court typically.
Well, I am now.
You are now. There are a lot of people who are in the same position. They weren't before, and they are now. Dahlia, thanks for being with us. Regardless of where you stand on this, we're going to be talking to you a lot about it, because you're one of the best minds about the Supreme Court. Dahlia Lithwick is a senior editor and legal correspondent for Slate.com. Well, the past three conservative Supreme Court justices were nominated by a president who lost the popular vote, and they were confirmed by senators representing a minority of Americans. The current conservative majority on the court is, in effect, minority rule. How do we fix that? That's next. We're now at the end of a Supreme Court term that has upended America's understanding of its Supreme Court. The legal architecture under which we've all existed for at least the past half a century has been fundamentally changed. And the question now is, what can be done about it? Brian Fallon is someone who's been near the center of power in Washington for over a decade. He served as a top aide for Senator Chuck Schumer, as a spokesman for Eric Holder when he was attorney general. He was the press secretary for Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign. But after the Electoral College handed Donald Trump the presidency, Brian Fallon decided to take a different path toward making change. He started by raising the alarm about America's broken institutions. And there was one institution in particular that he thought needed radical change, America's courts. In 2018, Brian Fallon co-founded an organization called Demand Justice, an organization whose mission was to make a broad majority of Americans understand the risks posed by the increasingly radical conservative majority on the Supreme Court and across lower courts as well. The group has pushed for sweeping changes to those institutions, sweeping changes to meet the urgency of what they say is a crisis in American jurisprudence. Brian Fallon has been warning us about this moment we're in now for nearly 4 years, and he and his organization have been thinking harder than any other about how to fix it. Joining us now is Brian Fallon, co-founder and executive director of Demand Justice. Brian, it's good to see you. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
What do you think needs to happen? What needs to happen to fix the Supreme Court? And what, in your opinion, is possible with fixing the Supreme Court?
Well, Ali, unfortunately, the events of the last week to 10 days, these huge cases involving gun safety, Roe, the ability for the EPA to regulate greenhouse gases. This is the culmination of a 50-year project that has been waged by the conservative legal movement, and it has frankly caught Democrats flat-footed. And it's an issue that is recently as 10 years ago when I was working in the Senate, I wasn't fully appreciating the urgency of it. And even during the 2016 campaign, when I worked on Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign, it was an issue, even though Merrick Garland's nomination was hanging in the balance, the opportunity to fill that Antonin Scalia seat was going to be decided by that election. Our voters, quite frankly, were not sufficiently motivated to come out and vote based on the Supreme Court. And that's a very dispiriting thing. But the events of the last few years, including the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett, now the decisions like the overturning of Roe that we saw last week, is causing the public to take notice. And so this is the positive thing that's happened. We have seen in poll after poll that the public disapproval of the Supreme Court as an institution is at its highest ever level. The public is crying out for something to be done to rein in the Supreme Court's power. And now we just need our party leaders to catch up to where the public increasingly is about wanting to corral this extreme, out-of-control Supreme Court. And what we, the problem that we have is we have a party leadership that I very much admire and people that I've worked closely to that came of age politically at a time where talking about the court was dangerous or politically risky because it was frequently an issue seen as motivating Republican voters more so than Democratic voters. But polls in the last few weeks have shown that that trend has shifted. And now Democratic voters and independents are saying that they are valuing the court as an issue in these midterms more than Republican voters are saying it. And so I think that we need our party leaders to react to this moment appropriately, channel the outrage that we're seeing in the public, and propose real serious proposals to rein in the court's power.
So when you talk about Democrats being caught flat-footed, in fact, over the last 40 or 50 years, have Republican voters been more motivated, or has this been the work of the Federalist Society and the Koch brothers and the Chamber of Commerce and the peppering of conservative judges in local districts and some financing for them so that they win elections based on name recognition? I mean, were conservative voters all that more motivated about it than Democratic voters were, or were conservative organizations spearheading the selection of judges and the appointment of judges to lower courts who subsequently became Supreme Court justices?
I believe it was both. I believe it was a confluence, a sort of unholy marriage between conservative elites, namely corporatist Republicans that wanted to switch the courts to be a bastion for free enterprise in their terms, to crush labor unions. This was the Lewis Powell memo in the 1970s. Lewis Powell became a Supreme Court justice thanks to Richard Nixon, but he was in the early 1970s an advisor to the Chamber of Commerce. And that was the era of the peak of the Warren Court, or the twilight of the Warren Court by the early 1970s. And he laid out a memo suggesting that conservative elites needed to start funding nonprofit institutions, needed to start being better represented in the legal academy, and start raising a new generation of law students that were trained to think in ways that were friendly to business interests. And in the forming of the Federalist Society, they founded an elite sort of petri dish that would train the next generation of law clerks and then judges to think and fashion these theories that Dahlia Lithwick in the previous segment was telling you, mm-hmm. that are not based on the Constitution, that are not based on notions of originalism, that are wholly fabricated out of whole cloth based on outcome-based reasoning. But what they did was they paired that with a political strategy that forged a union with the evangelical movement in this country, weaponized the Roe issue. The Roe issue was not something right after 1973. Mm-hmm. That was immediately something that the Republicans seized on. It was something that about a decade later, they realized had some political opportunity that they could mobilize voters at a grassroots level, and also gun voters, and animating the Second Amendment issue as a way to mobilize voters at the polls, really in service of a project that was conceived of by the Republican legal establishment elites. So it was both. It was an on-the-ground foot soldier strategy combined with a lot of resourced deep pockets and establishment types in the conservative legal movement.
Well, it's important to consider all of this now as we look at our court, and many Americans look at it with deep skepticism and disappointment. Brian, thanks very much for joining us tonight. Brian Fallon is the co-founder and executive director of Demand Justice. We appreciate your time. Coming up next, a small but important victory that gives the world reason to hope. Stick with us. In the first days of the Russian invasion, Vladimir Putin's troops were attacking Ukraine on many separate fronts, you'll recall. So it was sort of an eyebrow-raising moment when they decided to use their biggest ship to point its guns at this tiny Ukrainian outcrop in the middle of the Black Sea called Snake Island. What happened next is one of the most well-known stories of the war to date, because instead of surrendering as ordered to, the Ukrainian soldiers posted on the island told the Russians to go F yourself. And the excitement didn't last long. Russia eventually took control of the island, a plan with a purpose, by the way. By seizing Snake Island, Putin effectively set up a naval blockade, stopping anything from getting in or out of Ukraine's biggest port city of Odessa. This notably included food cargo. Ukraine is traditionally one of the world's leading suppliers of grain and sunflower oil. So for 4 months now, the Russians have occupied the island, blocking anything that tries to move past. And because Ukraine has very limited naval capacity, liberating the island has been almost impossible until today. Ukraine announced today that after a successful artillery and missile attack overnight, all Russians are now gone from the island. Quote, kaboom! No Russian troops on Snake Island anymore, said a top advisor to President Zelensky. Our armed forces did a great job. More kaboom news to follow. Russia is denying it. It says it was a voluntary withdrawal, a quote, gesture of goodwill to show that they are no longer obstructing the ports. But they left in the middle of the night on two speedboats, leaving behind a column of smoke. So you tell me. This, of course, is very good news for Ukraine, but many are wondering how they did it. How is it that after so many attempts, the Ukrainians finally kicked the Russians off of Snake Island? Well, it turns out they might have had a little bit of help. Quote, new weapons sent by the West made the Russian garrison even more vulnerable, especially HIMARS, a rocket system supplied by the United States, which Ukraine began fielding last week. Rob Lee of the U.S.-based Foreign Policy Research Institute said Russia's abandonment of the island was likely a tangible result of NATO arms deliveries to Ukraine. Ukraine's not asking for long-term promises or diplomatic visits. They want weapons, and they want them now. And when those weapons are delivered in a timely manner, they can make a difference to the outcome of this war. Case in point, Snake Island. Watch this space. That does it for us tonight. We're going to see you again tomorrow.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.